Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Everybody to Nightlight. Thanks for joining us tonight, sharing your evening with us. It's so good to have friends around all the time, and this is a very special night for me because we're starting a new aspect of Nightlight. But before we even go into that, I want to thank Ken Quiet Hawk for his amazing, amazing intro as always. You can find him at nativestorytellers.com. And he and his wife have a fantastic website there. I highly encourage you to check it out because it has material there that isn't taught in schools and yet can enrich you on a spiritual and cultural level beyond your imagination. So please do check it out. Tonight we have Mary Joyce with us, and she is the editor of the amazing website Skyships Over Cashiers. She's worked for the Orlando Sentinel in Florida as an artist and columnist, and for the Orlando Press in Michigan as a Sunday magazine editor, and then as a feature editor. She's written several books, all of which I've read, all except the latest one, which I haven't got my hands on yet. And that would be Bigfoot Beyond the Footprints. It's just out now. And I encourage you to check her books out. Not only are they beautifully written, but they're beautifully illustrated as well, which makes for a very enjoyable experience. She's also been a frequent host on many TV and radio shows. Her website, Skyships Over Cashiers, is a must-see for those interested in all things paranormal. Her subject matter covers a wide spectrum of material, and it's a pleasure to read. And not only is it beautifully put together, beautifully researched, and also checked and given references where it's appropriate, but she also has been doing this for well over 10 years, and all of her archives are there as well, so that beyond whatever she is putting up at the moment, she has 10 years of archives that you can go back and comb through and spend many a cold winter evening having a lovely time researching topics that aren't normally out there. So I encourage you to check it out. It's an amazing website. Nightlight welcomes Mary for a once-a-month visit to keep us updated and informed on what's new, interesting, and enlightening in the world. So, welcome to the show, Mary. I'm so delighted that we could start this out with a big bang.
Well, thank you for that very nice introduction. I appreciate it.
Well, I have to apologize to you. The link I sent to the website had more typos in it than I have ever seen in any archive. I've been sitting here horrified at, I must have been typing real fast when I did this one. I think I caught them all, so I think that on all of the archives that are going to go out, there won't be any typos. But my My person who checks typos has had bronchitis for the last 4 or 5 weeks and has not been focusing too well, I'm afraid.
if things like that happen.
Oh, my gosh. So just out of curiosity, how did you get the idea of putting this website together? Because it is so informative. There's so much different information on so many different topics. It's an amazing website.
I wish I could say that I was so brilliant that I foresaw what this was going to become, but it actually started out really simply. We were seeing, and many people were seeing, so many UFOs over this mountaintop town called Cashers, and that's the reason for the name. We were initially just focused on that kind of activity over that town. But it kept growing, and I was born with a curiosity, and the website has taken off in so many different directions. It's like if I get curious about Antarctica, which you and I have briefly touched on, then I delve into it. And I, like so many people, I get bored if I keep seeing the same thing over and over again, and that is another reason that we've grown into so many different topics.
Well, I love the fact that all of your archives are there and so easy to get to, so that, you know, if one is curious about what happened in 2008 or 2010, all your archives are there so that they can go back and read the articles. And
even now, if you go back into the archives, many, many people are going to find stuff that will be totally new to them. Not like it's archives that, everybody's familiar with that. It's just not the case, because there's just so much to know.
Well, I think one of the cool things about the Internet, among other things, is that when you get an itch to investigate something, you're able to stretch out and really, you know, pick up on it. And the topic that we kind of picked for tonight, although next month, I have ordered your book and I'm going to be getting it within the next week. So next month I want to really go into your book on Bigfoot, because I will have read it by then. But the subject in this last week's wonderful, groupings of different topics was Antarctica and the secrets behind it. And that's been a subject for me that I've been fascinated in for years. And you know, with Admiral Byrd in the 40s and or 38 or 40, I forget which it was, but you know, his material, and then the Nazis. The Antarctic seems to have been an area that has had a tremendous amount of activity in it, and yet it's all been squashed and kept undercover, and it hasn't been out there in public as much as it should be. And your article on it was just brilliant. It was fascinating to read and keep my interest even more.
And actually, there's quite a bit about Antarctica. We really started covering it in 2017, so that would be a good time to go into the archives. So 17, 18, and 19, we've had different kinds of articles about Antarctica. And probably a good place to start is with, like, the nuts and bolts of it. And we've been able to find, using Google Earth, three large entrances that go into Antarctica. And the most recent one that we discovered, to give people an idea of how big the entrances are, you could fly a 320 Airbus into the most recent one that we found. And one of the things I've done with all three entrances is I provide the coordinates. So you can copy and paste those into Google Earth, and you can find them for yourself. And I think that's important, because today we have too many people who get their kicks out of playing with Photoshop and creating things that simply aren't real. So when people can take the coordinates and find these things for themselves and realize they're real, I think that, you know, just is so much more convincing. But this last one that was found, imagine the side view of a fat mushroom. And the cap is the biggest, and then the stem is not quite as big. Well, this particular entranceway looks like that. And the top part is 115 feet across. I mean, it's 115 at the bottom part. And the wider part is 149 feet. And that means the Airbus could fly in there, because It has a wingspan of 117 feet, which gives you plenty of room on both sides. This particular entrance was doubly interesting because it's like there's a runway that approaches it. There's like 20 different what appear to be like lights or runway lights that stretch out over a mile in the direction of this entrance. And not only that, it's like it's over 200 miles from any known research facility. So what's it doing out in the middle of nowhere in Antarctica? So, like I said, we have visuals and photos with everything we have on the website. And if this kind of thing really interests people, just go to Global Links, which is on the homepage. And, you know, this is in the postings that are up there right now. And then you can go into 2017 and get some more of them. The other two entrances, I think, are back in the 2017 postings. And these are enormous entrances also. There's one that a Boeing 747 could fly into and still have 50 feet on either off either wingtip. That's huge. And, again, the coordinates are there. There's another one that looks like it has a metal awning over it. So these images are fascinating. And I was able to get pictures posted, and I think just a couple days after it was posted, some of this, they began to spill their India ink all over the images so that, you know, not everybody could find it. And I found a trick with that. I was able to get old pictures and find landmarks on the land. So if people are really interested in it, I give you directions so you can go back and still find where it was, even though great attempts were made to hide it from the public. And I guess somebody must be watching our website because that was the attempted blockout was done, I think it was like something like 2 days after we posted it.
Wow.
But anyhow, those are three hardcore entrances into Antarctica.
Well, I know that, you know, there were also on your website, I believe it was on your website, where you found that there were impressions of leaves and stuff in stones and things like that. So that, you know, Antarctica has not always been covered in miles and miles of ice. It at one time was a continent that was free of ice, and it was a temperate
zone.
Yeah,
there was two doctors from the University of Wisconsin that headed up an international team of researchers, and they went trekking across Antarctica in the end part of 2017. And I posted, seven photos of fossils that they found in that expedition. And they go back to a forest that existed 280 million years ago. So the landscape of our globe has changed, you know, just enormously over the millennia.
Well, I think one of my fascinations with Antarctica is that it seems to be cold, isolated, and barren. And yet Admiral Berg swore that he saw a hole and he flew into it, and he found Middle Earth, and there were diaries that said, you know, he spoke of his experience, and then he spoke of how he had been, you know, told to keep quiet and not talk about it, and then you hop forward, and there was Operation High Jump, where we sent our forces there to because we thought that the Nazis had some sort of base there, and I believe the Nazis did have a base there. From all that I've read, so that it's been an area where there has been a lot of activity and yet a lot of squashed activity, so that it's almost like, you know, don't go there, don't talk about it. There's that one area where the pilots were told not to fly over certain areas because there was underground stuff going on there. So it keeps piquing my curiosity, you know, what is there, and they have there are photographs, there are videos of people walking in huge caverns below the surface there. And it makes one wonder, just on the surface, there are lots of countries have men there and scientists and stuff like that. But it seems to me that has to be almost a ruse to make us think that, oh, they're just doing little experiments on the surface, when all of the good stuff is below the surface, and why haven't we heard any of this?
Well, what's amazing is this really goes back to before World War II, and back in the 30s, maybe even before that, but for the 30s for sure, the Nazis, or the Germans, were teaming up with a reptilian race of ETs, who I personally do not want to come in contact with. And so a lot of the technology that the Germans had, they were getting from the reptilians. And basically there are, from the reports I've gotten, is that there are three huge underground caverns that are occupied by the reptilians. And the Germans were given, one or two other ones that are much smaller. And they've been working together, forever. So underneath the ice, there's like a river, and they are probably more than one river, but there is a main river that the submarines can go into these caverns, and that's how things have been delivered in both directions. But, we think of the 1930s as forever ago, and anything before World War II seems like, that couldn't even be possible. One of the people, probably the number one person who convinced me that this has to be real is a man named William Tompkins. And he died as an old man. He was past 90 for sure. And he not only was in naval intelligence back in World War II and, was plugged into the Navy spies of that time, he later worked for NASA at the very highest levels. And he worked with, well-known names like Wernher von Braun. He said in his book that there were aliens that were working with NASA, and it was because of the aliens that a lot of this very fast and rapid space travel was developed. And he credits the aliens for so much of it. He did point out that there were two kinds of aliens. They were working with some that looked that passed for human, and then he said there were also reptilians. And I guess there were times when they would have a meeting, and these reptilians can change shape and appear human, and then after they're leaving the meeting, when they think they're not being watched, they some of them have seen them transform back into reptilians. So it's like the world of sci-fi. It just sounds so beyond what must be real. But this man, again, his name is William Tompkins, his credentials are just, immaculate. And he said that the Navy spies that he knew from, like, the World War II period said back then that the Germans, along with the reptilians, had the spacecraft that would actually fly to the moon. Now, that's a long time ago, a very long time ago. There were even claims, and I think he didn't know how to, confirm it, but some of the spies were saying they even were able to fly, to the stars or beyond the moon. But this was going on before Roswell. This was going on before we had any really sophisticated airplanes flying. Like I said, we're way behind the times.
Well, yeah, that's it's true. It's true that for whatever reason, this kind of information hasn't been leaked to the public. Well, it has been. Obviously, we're talking about it, but it isn't general knowledge, and people kind of poo-poo you when you start to talk about it. But I mean, when you look at the recent the Reese map, Antarctic is a continent. There's land there. It's not just ice. There is land there, and there had to have been cultures there and civilizations there before it froze over and is now under a mile or more of ice, so that there's a foundation there to build on. And they have discovered, haven't they, remnants of villages and stuff like that in some areas on the surface, haven't they?
There's evidence that there have been ancient settlements there. I posted two of the photos. They're not as convincing as some of the things I've seen, but they're definitely shapes and stuff that just shouldn't be there. So, you know, they might very, very well be the remnants of lost civilizations. They have something called... Yes. It's just a hotbed of all sorts of possibilities. There's one, I have both praise and criticism for one of the videos that we posted, and the heading for the article is just Antarctica, Video of Secrets Beneath the Ice. And it's about, the video is about 12 minutes long. I criticize it because they have these voices that are speaking like they know what they're doing and they have authority. I was able to recognize some of the voices. I was able to, like Linda Moulton Howell, I've heard her enough that I could recognize her voice. And at the very end, they give names, I think beneath the video where it's posted on YouTube. But you'd really have to do some research to match up the voices with the commentary. But disregarding that, they give you some, you know, good images and a good overview. If you don't have time to do tons of research, at least that gives you kind of a brief smorgasbord of, you know, what's going on there. It's a good place to start for people who don't know too much about it.
Well, I found it fascinating because, of course, you did put the Admiral Berg material up there as well.
He actually had two diaries. One, you know, that just about anybody who studied history at all knows about. And then his second one was regarded as a secret diary, and he wasn't even sure that would ever be exposed to the public when he was writing it, because obviously there was opposition to him doing that. But in that's the one, it's called The Missing Diary of Admiral Byrd, and it's a very short thing, but it talks to him about it talks about him in his plane, and it starts to wobble and, you know, fly funny, and then it like seems to come under control of something else because it's flying on its own and he's not doing it. And he ends up flying into the earth, and, you know, everything is green. And he talks about meeting somebody there that was called, introduced to him as the Master. And basically, the Master was telling him that they, beneath the earth, have always left the earth people alone. These are my words, not his. And it was because we discovered the atomic bomb that they got concerned. So they gave him, or the Master beneath the earth, gave Admiral Byrd this information and concern. But like so many people, even the heroes like the admirals are afraid to come forward and say things. And so during that very crucial time, he never shared that information. And you can only guess if it would have had any impact if he'd delivered that information or that message back in, I think it was 1947.
Well, the thing is, I believe that he did discover something. I'm not sure what, but I do believe he did discover something. And the government really shut him down and shut him up. But wasn't that material partial reason for Operation High Jump?
I honestly could not give you a straight answer on that. I don't know.
Because we did send...
It sounds like you know more about that than I do.
Well, we did send a whole bunch of ships and stuff down there, and they came back a lot faster than we anticipated, and some of the scuttlebutt was that they were attacked by by saucers, and you know they came back with their tails between their legs, so to speak. So,
well, there's a similar story that Linda Moulton Howe, who I believe is a really good researcher, was able to get from an interview with a Navy guy just known as Brian. And they were, I'll just call him Brian. Brian and his crew were the ones that were sent out to pick up somebody who had a severe health concern. And they were trying to save time, and they flew over this no-fly zone, which was against the rules, because they wanted to save time for this person. I believe they got in a bit of trouble for doing that. But by doing that, they saw this, you know, large hole going into Antarctica. They also saw saucer-shaped craft flying. And the other part of their story that kind of fits in with what you're talking about with the fear is that there was a group of researchers that were dropped off in Antarctica.
Oh, yeah.
And then they, Brian and his crew, when they went back to retrieve them, they couldn't find them. There was all their equipment and their tents or whatever they lived in was all still there, but there were no people. They did go back a second time, and they were able to find the people, and they acted like people who were in total shock. You know, this blank stare in their eyes. They wouldn't talk. They put them in the plane. I believe attempts were made to talk to them. They were just like people who had, you know, gone into the depths of hell or something very, very traumatic. So that is kind of along the lines of what you're saying, where the people come back and they, you know, they've seen something just beyond what they've been able to comprehend. And
well, you know,
it may be as simple as coming face to face with reptilians. I mean, you've probably seen pictures somewhere of reptilians. And if somebody like that just opened up my office door and walked in here right now, I'm sure my heart would start beating like crazy.
Well, you know, even, you're absolutely right. You know, even though I've been exposed to a lot of this stuff and everything, and there are some things that I have said to people, you know, it sounds feasible, but I won't believe it till I actually see it myself.
Well, you don't want to see everything, believe me.
No, I don't want to see everything, but I mean, there are a few things that I wouldn't mind, you know, having an angel walk up and talk to me would be kind of cool.
Oh, well, that's a different story.
Yeah. But it's sort of like, you know, I did see a UFO and when I was in college, and the kind of ridicule that I got and the teasing that I got and the I doubt it's and everything that were thrown at me for decades. I mean, I still talk about it, but you know, at the time, it was like I had leprosy, and it was sort of like nudge, not ask her about.
And
the
things
UFO,
things
you know?
Have changed. You know, things have changed. People who would have been critical of this website and what I'm doing, you know, 20 years ago, aren't laughing now. So I mean, there's been a lot of positive changes. Another thing I was thinking about is that I'm reading a book, and I just started it, so I'm not going to comment on it. But there is a man named Reverend Barry Downing, and he's a Presbyterian pastor who wrote a book back in 1968, and it was the Bible's in, I'm probably not getting it exactly right. It's like the Bible and UFOs. That may be the right title. And
no, that's Patrick's book. but he's
UFOs in the Bible, anyhow.
Yeah. Barry, he's been on Ancient Aliens. Yeah, he's quite a charming man.
Yes, he's a very nice man. And so he came out with another book in 2017, so that's the one I'm just starting to write or read. And what I found interesting, his first book was 1968, and certainly got a lot of people thinking in a brand new direction. That same year is when Eric Von Däniken came out with his book, Chariots of the Gods. That was another one that was very, very a mind changer for so many people, including myself. When that came out, that was just unbelievable. And, you know, even people like George Norrie with Coast to Coast, I think he points back to that book as being a real mind changer for him. So back in 1968, those were two significant books that really got people thinking differently.
Mm-hmm. And happily, the consciousness of humanity is such that, instead of, you know, deciding to burn the books or to, you know, burn people in effigy, you know, first they ridiculed, then they got interested, and then they became believers. So, you know, they were at least open to reading the information and then gestating it and deciding whether or not it they could comfortably live with it. And of course, there have been such, you know, such clusters, what huge clusters, waves of clusters of sightings of UFOs. After a while, it's very hard to, you know, ignore them. And then you have, you know, you have movies like Close Encounters of the Third Kind and things like that, that have made things a lot more familiar so that you know, the public is more accepting of them. And I have always said and always thought that movies and television are places where they seed our consciousness with being more comfortable with a lot of material that normally we wouldn't come in contact with. And so by the time the things that have been said to have been fantasy become reality, we accept them more comfortably.
And I'm sure that is done in two different ways. Some of the people who are creative are able to tap in or imagine things into the future, so there's that aspect of it. I also think there's deliberate manipulation. From what I've pieced together, Steven Spielberg, you know, had an inside track on some of the things he did.
Oh yeah, oh absolutely. I mean, when you look at Star Trek and the doors that open and shut for you, you know, we thought it was amazing when we saw it, but then now everybody going into any, you know, mall or anything like that, the doors open and shut, and we take it for granted. And, you know, their tricorders, our flip phones were very similar to those. And now our cell phones can do everything from scanning for a stud in the wall to GPSing you wherever you are on the globe. So the technology that they talked about way back is now something that is very much a part of our lives. And I'm hopeful that the consciousness of humanity at this point in time is more open to some of the shifts and changes that are coming, because certainly they must be coming. You know, there's so much that we have been kept, that has been kept secret from us, and yet probably secret from the government as well. But there's material coming out.
Depends on what aspect of the government. The government is multi-tiered, and the ones that we vote for are not at the highest level of control.
Oh, good Lord, no. And for that, I think sometimes we should be very grateful.
And sometimes it could go either way.
It can go, and probably will, and has, and will continue to. But I've often said to people that in many ways we are pawns in a game, and we don't even know what the game is. And you know, getting back to Antarctica, I mean, there is a. Is it a lake on the surface? I know that it shows blue, and there have been ships that come in and out of it, and that again is a no fly zone. And I keep wondering how can there be a lake in the ice? You know, how is it heated water that comes from beneath the surface?
Well, one of the things that and I'm sure I know I posted it somewhere. I couldn't put my finger on it right now. But if there are more volcanoes in western Antarctica than any place in the world, and the caverns underneath there where the reptilians and the Germans have their labs, those are old volcanic creations.
Lava tunnels,
and the first time I learned about that, you know, really, really surprised me.
Yeah, that is amazing, and yeah, that makes great sense. And
so, if you have volcanoes, and if the volcanoes are getting more active, then we're going to have more melting and more things revealed. And that's happening all over the world. You know, whether the volcanoes are warming things up, you know, clearly the Earth is warming up.
Oh, yeah. And I think the volcanoes, too. I think the Ring of Fire has, not at this moment, but there have been moments that it has been very, very active, so that not only the volcanoes, but earthquakes as well. And I keep talking about the New Madrid fault line because I get the feeling that it's going to go off again, and I have a feeling that the government thinks so too, and yet there's not anything that's been done to sort of prepare people for that possibility. And it last time it went off, it was an 8 or a 9 on the Richter scale.
Yeah, I can't remember when that was. Do you?
Yeah, 1839, I think, 38 and 39.
I knew it was some time ago, but I didn't have
yeah.
any idea on the date. And
yeah,
I know that there's been concern ever since then that it could do the very same thing again.
It rang bells in Boston. So.
Oh,
wow. You know, yeah. Oh, it was the devastation. I mean, if you're curious about it, the New Madrid fault line, it goes kind of right up and down, almost parallel to the Mississippi. And
right.
when it went off this last time, the Mississippi ran backwards. So, you know, it was totally devastating. But the land at that time wasn't that populated. But,
right.
you know, if it went off now, holy mackerel.
Well, stop
know,
and think about this. You know, you were saying, you know, the people should be warned. Well, think
mm-hmm.
about what's happening on our coastlines. We've been having storms that have wiped out towns sometimes more than once, and yet people
mm-hmm.
go back and build in the same place. So
yeah.
what, you know, we have these terrible fires out in California, and people want to go back and build right where the fires happened. You know, they want to, you know, go back and live there again. So what does it take? I mean, we seem to be very, as a species, very resistant to change.
And yet,
you know, for a long time, the water's been bubbling up through the manholes in South Florida whenever there's a high tide. So
mm-hmm.
why do people keep wanting to build there? I mean,
you can't even
warn people because there it is
no.
right in front of them, and they still want to build their houses.
But yet in China, apparently along the coastline, there are places where there have been landmarks put on stone that say don't build beyond this point because they have known that tsunamis would wash up and come to that point, so that anything that was, you know, that was built before that would be washed away. I mean, we have been warned in so many ways, and as a culture, we haven't paid attention to it. Though at this point in time, I'm still shaking my head and wondering, New Orleans is below sea level. Why are they building there?
The man who has put in our cable system where I live got
uh-huh.
into a conversation with him. He's originally from New Orleans, and his family owns a lot of land down south of New Orleans. It's now 3 feet underwater. All of the
yeah.
land that the family owned is 3 feet underwater. That's not going to be redeemed.
No.
I mean, there's tons of stories like this, you know, but nobody listens.
Well,
go
yeah,
figure.
I guess, well, yeah, I mean, I think the Earth plane is going through a process that has gone through, you know, we're millions of years old, and I think that this has happened over the millions of years any number of times. We just... It's not in our lifetime that we've seen this kind of cycle, so that we're in the middle of a cycle that is probably a repeat of something that has happened countless times before. But, you know, instead of trying to blame everybody about it, you know, the Earth is going through a process of cleaning itself up and getting rid of the riffraff. And unfortunately, in some cases, we're the riffraff. So, I mean, look what happened to the islands that the hurricanes have hit, people, you know, they've been wiped clean, and yet people are going to go back and build. And,
right.
you know, frankly, I would take the hint the first time, and I would take my money, and I would go inland as far as I could get.
Well, there, you know, I don't know the details on it because I haven't paid enough attention to it, but after the hurricane hit the Bahamas, this most recent
mm-hmm.
one, another hurricane or a tropical storm came through, and there was an earthquake. I don't remember all the details, but there was a 6-point earthquake in one of those island areas, the same ones that had been hit with the hurricane. And I'm going, man, if that doesn't get you moving, you just,
mm-hmm. but you know,
you know, I don't know what to say.
I think that a lot of things too, a lot of the weather cycles that we're seeing, I truly believe HAARP is partially to blame for some of them.
And that's another thing they're trying to hide from us. I used to be able to get HAARP maps, and you could absolutely see how they generated storms. The maps were just crystal clear. And again, you'd have to go into the probably type in HAARP in the search bar and go back into the archives to find it. But they were incredible how you could pinpoint the storms from the HAARP maps. And now nobody has access to them. You can't even get a...
I believe the tsunami that hit Haiti was caused by HAARP.
Might very well be. Oh, yeah, that one. That was before it was taken off the Internet. And,
mm-hmm.
yes, that very much looked like it was done very, very deliberately.
So, I mean, I understand scientists making a mistake, but they're making big mistakes.
Well, it looks like it's being done on purpose.
It does, and it's a matter of manipulation, and what are they trying to do? Are they trying to get us all in one place and, you know, so they can control us or what? You know, it does, you start to question, you know, why are these things happening? I mean, our hurricane seasons, our nor'easters, the storms that we have are now much more severe than they ever have been. Now,
all right, your regulars probably already know, but tell us exactly where you're located.
I'm in Connecticut.
On the coast?
No, inland.
Inland. Okay.
I was on the coast for 50 years. And,
were you?
For 50 years, we on a regular basis had Long Island Sound in our basement. And it was amazing, you know, when at one point I lived in Westport, Connecticut, and we had a nor'easter that hit at high tide at full moon.
Mm.
Now
that's a full load. That's locked and loaded, as they say.
Oh my goodness, at one moment I looked outside and, you know, it was rough out there, but it wasn't bad. I was right on the water then. And not 10 minutes later, I had 4 feet of water around my house.
Mm.
And it was amazing. Happily, it was a split level, so we were on the second floor. And literally, I could go out on my deck off the second floor, and I could almost touch the water level.
Mm.
It was that high. And
so you've been through it.
Oh yes, I know storms. But and for the most part I enjoy a good hurricane. But you know, not if I'm in a place that's being destroyed by it. I have been known to walk my dog and fly my dog because the dog was so light the wind just picked him up and I had her on a leash obviously. And, you know, there was no way she was going to be able to use the facilities outside when she was floating in the air. So we had to make other arrangements for a short
time. Sounds like a cartoon.
It truly happened. But you know, I think the weather is a magnificent thing. And I think two seasons, my second husband and I, we sailed a 140-foot square rigger out of Atlantic City with the public on it, and there is nothing like being on a ship that size and feeling the wind fill the squares and surge you ahead.
Mm.
So the weather is an incredible thing, and it should be respected greatly. And like you said before, if you have been, you know, destroyed and everything that you've owned has been washed away, it doesn't take a genius to say, maybe I should build elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's so disastrous, the seeing everything you own suddenly floating by you is a scary thing. I know when our basement flooded, you know, everything that was down there in cabinets and stuff, if it couldn't be washed, it had to be thrown away.
Oh, the mildew comes in real quick.
Oh, overnight. And you know, so you learn. You learn how to, you know, what you put down there and what you find a place, you know, in a higher elevation for. But the reality is, if this kind of storm, if your house isn't built for it, then it behooves you to either prepare your house for it or to move to another place where, you know, you're not going to be hit by stuff. Now, I have to admit that I'm planning on moving to Nashville, and of course they have tornadoes there, and so I'm pretty sure that, you know, a tornado or two is going to drive by me. But I've had two tornadoes hit on either side of my house last year. One went right down the road and popped all of the telephone poles out, and the other one took out 150, 200-year-old oak trees out.
Mm.
And it's kind of like, okay, I'm moving. You don't need to say anything more. I'm moving.
I got the message.
Tornado Alley, but the reality is, you know, you have to respect the weather. You have to, you know, do your due diligence. And you know, it boggles my mind that houses in Nashville don't have basements.
Well, Nashville is not in the center of where the worst tornadoes go through or where the most go through. So don't be excessively worried about that.
No, I'm not. But if the new Madrid line goes off, it's in the area of big destruction. So,
mm-hmm.
But I'm moving there, so probably the new Madrid line's going to go off just as soon as I settle in and get all my dynamo. But
a little bit of optimism there, huh? Wow.
No, it's just that I know that, you know, there's always excitement, and you know, a good storm, love them. We're getting down to you know, just about 12 minutes here before we have to sign off. But I did want to talk briefly. Your new book, Bigfoot Beyond the Footprints, is now out, and people can get it. And next month we're going to talk about it because I will have had a chance to read it. And what drove you to write this book? Because it looks fascinating.
I realized how much I'd done in the way of research for the website. And
mm-hmm.
at the time I wrote the book, I had more than 65 Bigfoot stories that had been posted. And it's very difficult for people to like wade through and find all the stuff because it comes out at different times, though we
mm-hmm.
do have an ET and Bigfoot section. So you can get lost in there if you want to, and there's lots in the archives. But I just had all this incredible information. I thought I need to put this together in one place. So that was one motivation. A second motivation was I'm sick and tired of people going on and on about Bigfoot footprints, you know, the casting and the feet and, you know. So that's the reason for the title, Bigfoot Beyond the Footprints. And I don't have all my information in front of me, but basically the Bigfoot, they have families. Some people have become friends with them, or they've become friends with some humans. There have been situations where the Bigfoot have actually rescued people. They have a very unique biology. There's language. I mean, I get into those kind of things rather than just what I call the nuts and bolts of prints.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody's into Bigfoot at all, they certainly have seen enough of those to be convinced that there must be something to them. And I just wanted to go beyond that.
Well, I'm glad because, you know, to me, they don't feel malicious at all. And they, you know, they're not puppy dogs either, but they deserve, I think, more respect than we've given them. And these people that go out trying to hunt Bigfoot and kill one to offend me greatly because these.
Well, that's one of the reasons that I do not pinpoint where these sightings happen. I'll give the general area, but I won't pinpoint them. And what surprises me is that in this half of the country, there are as many Bigfoot as there are because, you know, the population of humans is so much more dense, and yet we still have Bigfoot. I think the Bigfoot in this part of the country, on the eastern half of the Mississippi, are quieter, and I think they're very much better perhaps at hiding in plain sight or staying out of view. The wild stories with lots of noise and all of that is much more common in the Western Rockies or, you know, out toward the West Coast and the Rockies really. And so I think they're different in for that reason alone. I also think that the bigger ones tend to be out in the West. The smallest ones are called skunk apes down in Florida, and we're kind of in the middle range here where I am, which is in the mountains of Western North Carolina.
From what I have read, and obviously not as much as you, but you know the most aggressive they get are throwing rocks and sticks at people. You know, they don't go attacking, and they don't go, you know, let's wipe out these campers or anything like that. So to me, I don't understand why people haven't really tried to, and you know, you said they have become friends with some people and they have trusted some people. So it's a start. I just...
Now, we do have, at the very end of the book, I do have a little section on when Bigfoot turns violent. And I give one case out in South Dakota with the Lakota Indians. And it's basically, I have found that there are two main reasons why they get violent. If people are hunting them and shooting at them, they get really pissed. And if somebody was shooting at us, we would be upset too. So that is the most common thing. This story that I shared out in Dakota, they were hunting, and it makes an interesting story, so I'll just hit the highlight. And the highlight is that they were out in a remote part of the reservation, the Indians were, and they were hunting the same deer that the Bigfoot was hunting. The Bigfoot has to survive on what it can hunt, and it was trying to it was throwing rocks and trying to, you know, scare the people away because really, you know, they have to hunt. They have to survive. And the hunters who really didn't have the food, you know, were taking something that the Bigfoot really needed.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, and also if you put their family or their children in jeopardy, they're going to get, those are the three things that I have seen where there have been reports of violence. Usually it's
totally,
the hunters.
Totally understandable. Also, I wanted to get out there while we have the ears of, I don't know, at least three or four people, a lot more, I'm sure. You're going to be doing a conference on October the 12th called Creatures, Legends, and Lore. You want to talk a little bit about that and give people information about it?
Let's see if what I can remember off the top of my head. It is on October 12th, which is a Saturday. It's in Gatlinburg at the Convention Center. It's a one-day, all-day event. And the last I heard, there's going to be 12 speakers. I will be one of them. And I will be talking about Bigfoot and little people and maybe some of the other odd things like strange dogs and strange owls and things like that here in North Carolina, and I've got most of a PowerPoint together, and my PowerPoints are lots of photos, and I've learned how to do transitions, visual and sound, and so it will not just be me up there throwing words into the air.
Are you doing the AAPS conference as well?
Not that I know of, no.
Okay. I was trying to, I know you've got another conference you're doing towards the end of October, I think.
At the end of October, I'm going to be down in Florida. I don't know exactly what's developing there, but I'll be gone for a week for that one. Most of what I do is get out and do my own research, get behind the computer and write for the website, and I enjoy doing the radio talk shows. It's a nice way to get information out there. That tends to be where I put most of my energy. I really haven't, gotten on like the circuit, so to speak.
Well, you've written three other books that were fascinating, and I've read them all. And
well, I appreciate you're very kind. Thank you so much.
Well, listen,
and each one's different. Each one's
they
different.
They are.
You know.
They are, and you know, you have one on the little people, one on Jesus, one on I forget what the third one is.
Underground military bases hidden in North Carolina mountains.
Yeah.
So, and actually, the one that is the most difficult to sell is the Jesus one. Deals with scientific and archaeological information about Jesus. It expands on our understanding of him. But the conservative Christians think they know everything already and that everything's in the Bible and there's nothing else. So we lose that audience. And the people that are more open-minded are so tired of the conventional Christianity that they don't want to have anything to do with it. But it's really kind of interesting information. And it gets into things where it's very convincing that he did live like a human being and he was indeed married, and information supporting that has come out in a number of different ways, some of it by academic researchers.
Yeah, and, your books, among other things, are, you have lots of photographs in them, at least the ones that I've seen, that I've read.
Yeah, I do that always because we're in a very visual world.
Absolutely, and your text that goes along with it is very conversational. It's not heavy duty. It doesn't make you feel like you're in school. It's enjoyable reading that educates as well. So it's a wonderful writing style because you don't feel, oh God, should I take notes? and if you buy the book, you can highlight, of course. But it's material that you can grab the book, you can find the material, and you can refer back to it easily instead of, a 500-page book where you just your eyes...
Where it's laborious, where it's a big effort, right?
Oh, yeah. And so they're a pleasure to read. And, you can pick them up and put them down and they're so informative that it's a wonderful thing to have on hand. It's a casual read, but it's an informative read. So I highly encourage everybody to check out your books and your website and the archives especially, because there's so much information there that it's not time sensitive. It's informationally sensitive, and it builds upon itself so that you can follow different material through time. And like I said, your archives start in 2008, so that's 11 years of material for somebody to spend, a good winter's evening just chuckling, because it's fun material to read. You don't make it so serious that it's, oh God. It's
right.
It's more of an, oh my goodness, look at that. We are down to the last couple of seconds. I want to thank you so very much for spending this hour with me. And
thank you for all your kind words, and I enjoyed talking to you. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're so very welcome, and we will be back next month, and we will be going into some Bigfoot material and possibly other stuff as well. So stay tuned, everybody. She's going to inform us in spite of ourselves. So good night, Mary, and good night, everybody.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.